Thursday, October 15th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a worldwide surge in coronavirus cases has health officials warning more deaths could follow.
The numbers just keep going up.
With 3 weeks to go before the U.S. presidential election, concerns of violence have states stepping up plans for security.
They are getting prepared. They want to have all these possibilities gamed out so they know, in the worst case scenario, what do they need to do.
Also ahead, a difficult year means another musician lending his talents in an appeal for love and unity. It's all on today's International Edition. With less than 3 weeks to go before the upcoming presidential election, officials across the United States charged with keeping voters safe or taking additional precautions and bracing for the possibility that November 3rd and the days that follow could be marred not just by potential cyber attacks, but by violence. Joining us now is VOA national security correspondent Jeff Seldon. Jeff, what is specifically is driving these concerns?
Well, there are a couple of things that are driving these concerns. First, you have the high-profile case in Michigan where the FBI was involved and busted up a plot where some members of an extreme militia were planning to kidnap the governor of Michigan. And the FBI revealed this past week that some of those same plotters were thinking about doing the same, kidnapping the governor of Virginia. So that type of extremism within the U.S., domestic extremism, is something that the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security have been increasingly concerned about, and they've been increasingly concerned about how that is going to play out, how those extreme views and divisions within the U.S. will play out during the election. In addition, some of the states have been warning that this is dangerous. Specifically, at the end of September, the New Jersey Department of Homeland Security came out with an updated threat assessment that said if there are delays with the election results or with the recounts, that could likely spark protests. And the longer it takes to get official results, the more likely the chances are that there will be some violence, whether it's just lone actors who hold extreme views or whether it's groups that are looking to exploit a prolonged situation. And that's been a real concern from the states, because the states themselves have said counting the votes are going to take longer because of all of the mail-in ballots. Some states like Michigan, for example, which says it may not have final results until the Friday after the Tuesday election. So you're talking about 80 or so hours after the polls close. They can't even start counting votes that from mail-in ballots until the morning of the election. So there could be some delayed vote totals. And so with all the and confusion and political division already existing within the country, states are taking the potential for election-related violence very seriously, and they're talking with their law enforcement officers and they're talking with the FBI so they can be prepared on how to handle it should something happen.
How unprecedented is it for the FBI to take such a proactive step or steps like this ahead of a presidential election? We haven't, that I recall in recent years, had this level of concern.
The level of concern is much, much bigger. And it gets back to some of the assessments that the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security have shared with lawmakers and with the public about the biggest internal threats to the United States. In the past couple of years, and this year in particular, both DHS and the FBI have said the biggest threat to the United States domestically are domestic terrorists, extremist groups within the U.S. And for the most part, they say that while some of that includes radical Islamic terrorists and groups that are inspired, a large component of the threat comes from homegrown groups that are often, in their words, aligned with white supremacist views, radical views here in the U.S. Domestic politics feeding into those concerns is the knowledge that the FBI and counterintelligence officials have that foreign adversaries, and they say in this case mostly Russia, although other countries are doing it too, have been trying to play on those divisions and feed disinformation and misinformation to increase the political divide, to increase the animosity, increasing the chances that something could happen, that there could be some violence.
Are states being proactive and taking the warnings and concerns seriously? Are they taking actions to to be ready for anything that might come up like this?
Look, some of the boldest, starkest warnings have come from state officials who are taking this threat very, very seriously. One of the first states to talk about it publicly was New Jersey with its updated threat assessment, which talked about various scenarios going from just some protests, spur-of-the-moment protests that turned violent to something much more planned and perhaps much more deadly, to just states talking to the FBI, talking to their law enforcement agencies to make sure that voters who choose to vote and go to the polls on Election Day can do so without being intimidated, can do so safely. There was a call this week from the National Association of Secretaries of State, and secretaries of state in 40 of the 50 U.S. states are actually in charge of running the elections, which are done in the United States. It's not a national election. The states run the elections themselves, and then all those results go into tallies, and you figure out who won the presidential election. So they have been talking with each other. They have been talking with law enforcement agencies in their own states, but they also say that the FBI, New Mexico, Louisiana, say in particular that they've had outreach from the FBI working with them. The Secretary of State from New Jersey said that they are planning on check-ins on Election Day with law enforcement and the FBI just to make sure things are going smoothly and to be on the lookout for whether it's something on social media or other bits of misinformation, accidentally bad information, or purposefully erroneous disinformation that is out there that could spark something more serious. The states are taking this very seriously. They can call on the National Guard in some cases if they have concerns, but they are getting prepared. They want to have all these possibilities gamed out so they know in the worst case scenario, what do they need to do to bring things under control. Right now, they're confident that they're going to be able to do that.
VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden, thanks for being with us. The number of confirmed COVID-19 infections worldwide has accelerated in recent days with more than 38 million cases and a death toll exceeding 1 million as of Wednesday. The United States remains the worst hit country in the world, followed by India and Brazil. And European nations are closing schools, canceling surgeries, and enlisting student medics as already overwhelmed health workers face a potential COVID-19 nightmare scenario at the onset of winter. In France, a surge of new cases is prompting the government to declare a new public health state of emergency, as President Emmanuel Macron on Wednesday announced new plans to stop a concerning situation from getting worse. Joining us from Paris is reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, thanks for being with us as always. Macron expressed concern that people are not taking this seriously, and he indicated that the virus has been spreading at parties and private gatherings. So what new restrictions is he now putting into place to combat this latest surge?
France, like most of the other European nations, is struggling to contain the coronavirus. And it was in a television interview that Emmanuel Macron announced that as of this Saturday, there will be a curfew from 9 p.m. until 6 a.m. in Paris and in eight other cities across the country. That means that around a third of the French population will be at home during that time. Now, Emmanuel Macron said this is because the numbers just keep going up. The infections are now regularly coming in at 20,000 new infections per day. He says that's got to get down to around 3,000, possibly as much as 5,000, but that's the maximum per day, because he said anything beyond that, there is the risk that the health service just cannot cope. He understands that people do have families, people need to move around, but he said, look, this is with us, this coronavirus, it's going to be with us for the long term. Everyone's got to learn to socially distance. And that was the point that he kept making. It was quite a long interview for him, 45 minutes. He said, we need to have more common sense. People need to just become automatic in wearing a face mask and social distancing.
Where are some other hotspots? I've heard Germany and Netherlands potentially, but I also have heard that Germany seemed to be doing a better job and having better success than most places in Europe.
Indeed. In the first wave back in the spring, Germany was really leading the way when it came to containing the virus. But now it itself is having problems. We're looking already on Wednesday, some 5,000 1,000 new infections across the country. So that is a worry. You've got the capital, Berlin, that's got a nighttime curfew. Everyone has to be home by 11 o'clock at night. You're also looking at other areas that will be able to introduce similar curfews, certainly if the infections start rising again. You've got Spain, Catalonia in the northern region around Barcelona. Bars and restaurants have been closed for the next 15 days. The Netherlands has got lockdown from 10 p.m. at night as well. Belgium, bars and restaurants have now been closed. They'll be closed for at least a month. So you're seeing, you're really Europe having to pay for the fact that it was so open and there was so much movement during the summer months.
And what about Italy? Very early on in this pandemic, one of the worst hit in the world, and it seemed like they finally had gotten it under control. What's going on there now?
They had a very successful summer. They kept cases under control. But on Wednesday, Italy as well had its highest daily increase in infections that it's had since the start of the pandemic. And cases are rising. In fact, the head of the Italian doctors' unit has said that if infections keep rising at this rate, then the whole health service will just not be able to cope. They're looking at the possibility of you having to move people abroad to get health care, having to put people on trains as they were doing back in the spring, and have them go to Austria for treatment. So that is now the worry, certainly in Italy and in France, that the health service will just not be able to cope. And one of the reasons for that is not just because you've got too many people for beds, but also the doctors and the nurses. They've been working in these hospitals, in the intensive care units now, for more than 6 months, and they are not just physically tired, but they're also emotionally drained. And that was another point that the French president made during this interview. He said, we cannot keep asking so much of our medical staff when, in fact, the solution is just everyone to have a bit more common sense.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, thank you so much. Weeks after she and the president tested positive for the coronavirus, First Lady says that their teenage son also tested positive. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Melania Trump says she was relieved when 14-year-old Barron first tested negative, but her fear came true when he then tested positive. In a post on the White House website, she writes Barron has since tested negative, calling him a strong teenager who showed no symptoms. She writes she is glad the three of them went through it at the same time so they could take care of each other. Outside the White House,
Barron's fine.
The president quickly segued into praising High Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett's performance at her confirmation hearings.
Amy, I think, is doing an incredible job.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
The U.S. Food and Drug Administration Wednesday announced its first approved treatment for Ebola virus infection in adults and children, approval of Regeneron's Inmazeb, a mixture of three monoclonal antibodies, follows a U.S. government-supported trial and expanded access protocol. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar, in a statement, noted that ending the Ebola outbreak was one of the Trump administration's top global health priorities over the past 2 years. Last weekend, there was a ceasefire in the battle for Nagorno-Karabakh, a breakaway region inside Azerbaijan controlled and inhabited by ethnic Armenians. It lasted for only hours, or maybe even minutes. Fierce national pride is growing on both sides as towns and cities are attacked and civilians run for cover. VOA has this report with Jan Bolshat in Nagorno-Karabakh.
Friday afternoon in Stepanakert, the capital of Nagorno-Karabakh. For more than 2 weeks, this city and others on both sides of this conflict have been frequently bombed.
Hey, hey! Let's go there.
Go there?
Where are everybody?
We went that way. Here we go.
Which way?
That way.
Let's go inside that building there. Let's go now. There's a building there.
Ready?
Here we go.
One.
Go.
The sirens are supposed to go off before the strikes, but that's not always the case.
We're good.
After more than 2 weeks of renewed fighting in this 30-year-old conflict, more people can be found underground in this city than on the streets. In the bomb shelter, Hamayek Vanyan carries a shovel as he tries to fix up the dusty hallway to be more comfortable for civilians. He says he fought in the 1990s and his son is fighting now. But this war is different, he says, with advanced weaponry raining down on cities and towns. The next morning, a truce is declared, brokered by Russia. But within an hour of the ceasefire, both Armenia and Azerbaijan accuse each other of new attacks. On Sunday, a rocket hits Ganja, Azerbaijan's second largest city, about 100 kilometers from the front lines. Several civilians are killed. Vesli Mahmudova, a resident of Ganja, calls the violence in her home city tyranny that has torn apart her family. Her nephew and her sister-in-law are wounded, and her other nephew is fighting on the front lines. Armenians say the chance of losing this region to Azerbaijan threatens their very existence as a people with a homeland. Azerbaijanis say the area has been illegally occupied for nearly 30 years, leaving hundreds of thousands of people displaced. Hundreds have died, including dozens of civilians from both sides. This is Pargev Martirosyan, Archbishop of Artsakh, the Armenian local name for Nagorno-Karabakh.
Sooner or later it will become, you know. Sooner or later every war will finish, will stop. But when it will come?
A few minutes later, the Archbishop retreats to the church basement after a bomb blast somewhere in the city. For now, the war is mostly between Armenia and Azerbaijan. But Turkey is already openly supporting Azerbaijan, and Russia has a security pact with Armenia. Locals here say their tragedy can easily spread if this conflict turns into a large-scale multinational war. Reporting for VOA News with Jan Boishat in Nagorno-Karabakh.
Supporters of a group of Cameroonian asylum seekers who entered the United States decried their expected deportation Wednesday, saying they could face persecution back home. Some in Cameroon say some of those seeking asylum instigated violence in the country's separatist conflict and should face charges. But as Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from the city of Douala, Cameroon's state media is putting a positive spin on the return.
More than 20 Cameroonians gathered Wednesday at the Douala International Airport to await relatives expected to be deported from the United States. 27-year-old Jennifer Monet says she fears her older brother will be at risk if he is forced back to Cameroon. Last year, she says, he fled fighting in Cameroon's Anglophone separatist conflict.
You are either afraid of separatist fighters or you are afraid of the military. And leaving these regions and going to the Francophone parts of Cameroon, they look at you as a separatist, and leaving Cameroon and going to the U.S. to seek asylum, and yet they want you back in Cameroon where you don't have peace, you don't have any freedom, really. It's a violation of human rights.
Monet says she is looking for another country that will accept her and her brother. Cameroon's government has not confirmed the deportations or expected arrivals. But State Cameroon Radio Television, CRTV, this week reported that a chartered flight was expected Wednesday from Dallas, Texas, with 126 deported asylum seekers on board. CRTV reported 86 of them were Cameroonians and the rest were believed to be from the Democratic Republic of Congo. In August, government-led protests in front of the U.S. Embassy in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, called for Washington to either charge or deport Cameroonians who allegedly were backing Anglophone rebels. Activist Hilda Manga participated in the protests and says those who were deported from the U.S. should be investigated and punished if they supported the separatists.
That is a great initiative which must be applauded, because it is high time they are sent home to face charges and answer to the crimes they have committed. They should return home, and let's see how together we can put an end to this crisis that has kept the masses suffering for four good years.
Cameroon's state media gave no indication as to when the asylum seekers would face arrest and put a positive spin on their return. CRTV said they were needed to help rebuild Cameroon and that authorities had sent medical experts to take care of them before, during, and after their deportation. Alexandra Lamarche works with the group Refugees International as a senior advocate for West and Central Africa. She says the deportations are appalling.
In the case of many Cameroonians seeking asylum in the U.S., they have fled the country fearing attacks from the government. Many are from the conflict-ridden Anglophone region or supported opposition parties or have been vocal about the authorities' poor human rights track record. Regardless of why they came, most of them will undoubtedly face retaliatory attacks from the government upon their return.
U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, as a policy, does not comment on deportations until after they have occurred. The Cameroonians entered the U.S. last year via South America and Mexico. The administration of President Donald Trump has been cracking down on illegal immigrants and making it harder for asylum claims to be approved. Fighting broke out in 2016 after Cameroon's military cracked down on Anglophones calling for an independent state within the mainly French-speaking country. Cameroon's English speakers say they are treated as second-class citizens and given fewer jobs and support from the state. The United Nations says more than 3,000 people have been killed in Cameroon's separatist conflict and half a million others displaced. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Douala, Cameroon.
Lebanon and Israel, still technically at war, have begun indirect talks over their disputed maritime border. International Edition's Steve Miller gets details from George Ide in Beirut, who describes local reaction on the delicate diplomacy efforts.
Well, it is a long process since it has been tackled a few times over the years. However, today, Lebanon and Israel held a short opening round of indirect talks over their disputed maritime border on Wednesday. The meeting that lasted for an hour ended after a second round was announced to be held on October 28th. The talks were held at the headquarters of the UN Interim Force in Lebanon, UNIFIL, in Nakura, just north of the UN demarcated blue line separating Israel and Lebanon. Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs David Schenker and UN Special Coordinator for Lebanon Jan Kubis attended the historic opening session. Negotiators that sat around the same table did not talk directly to each other. A UN mediator instead was communicating each team's message to the other. This shows a bit the type of relation that exists between Lebanon and Israel. Israel sent a seven-member team, including the Director General of its Energy Ministry, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's foreign policy advisor, and the head of the Army Strategic Division, along with another military member. Lebanon's four-member delegation comprised had included two army officers, a Lebanese oil official, and a maritime border law expert.
George, as you mentioned, this isn't the first time the two nations have tried to sort this out and had discussions to resolve this issue. What's been the reaction to the talks where you are in Beirut?
Iran-backed militia Hezbollah and its ally Amal had criticized the delegation representing Lebanon at the talks. In a statement issued a few hours before the meeting, the two main Shia parties called for the reform of the negotiating team, which they claimed must include only military officials without any civilians or politicians, because it contradicts the 1996 framework agreement. which allows only military officers to attend the periodic meeting on border demarcation. Also, the Lebanese government expressed on Monday opposition to the presidency's mechanism of appointing the four-member negotiation team.
And what about Israel?
Israeli media reported that the senior Israeli energy minister, ministry official said that if the talks go well, it will be possible to move forward towards a deal within weeks or months, as he claimed. The head of the Lebanese delegation in the demarcation negotiations, Brigadier General Bassam Yassin, said after the meeting that indirect technical negotiations are a first step in the in a thousand-mile march of the demarcation of the southern borders. And he added, we are looking forward to proceed at a pace that will enable us to complete this file within a reasonable time limit. He also hoped that the other parties will fulfill their obligation according to the requirements of international law, and they will preserve the confidentiality of the talks.
George Ide in Beirut, speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Australia is trying to clarify reports of a Chinese ban on its coal imports. Industry sources have said Beijing told energy providers and steel firms to stop buying Australian coal. As Phil Mercer reports from Sydney, trade tensions between the Asia-Pacific partners have deteriorated in recent years.
Coal is one of the major Australian commodity exports to China, behind iron ore and liquefied natural gas. So any disruption to this multi-billion dollar trade would hurt. State-owned energy providers and steel mills in China have reportedly been told not to buy Australian coal. Australian officials believe it could be temporary and part of informal quotas in China, or an attempt to restrict imports to protect China's domestic coal mining industry. However, analysts have speculated that the reported ban on Australian coal could be part of an emerging trade war. Earlier this year, China was infuriated when Canberra called for a global investigation into COVID-19, which was first detected in the Chinese city of Wuhan. Relations have also soured over allegations of Chinese interference in Australia's domestic politics, cyber espionage, and the detention of Australian citizens in China. Beijing has accused Australia of being anti-China. Australian Trade Minister Simon Birmingham says he's not confirmed that coal exports to China are being disrupted.
We have also been working to seek a response from Chinese authorities in relation to the accusations that have been made publicly, but we take the reports seriously enough, certainly, to try to seek some assurances from Chinese authorities that they are honouring the terms of the China-Australia Free Trade Agreement.
Earlier this year, Beijing effectively banned imports of Australian barley, placed restrictions on meat, and discouraged students and others from travelling to Australia. In August, China said it had launched an anti-dumping investigation into Australian wine imports. China is Australia's biggest trading partner. Australia owes its recent prosperity in large part to Chinese demand for iron ore and other resources. Given this economic reality, standing up to Beijing isn't easy. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Music icon Stevie Wonder has released two new singles appealing for unity amid the challenges of systemic racism and the coronavirus pandemic, and plans to donate all proceeds of one of the songs to the nonprofit Feeding America. Wonder said he started writing the songs Where Is Our Love Song and Can't Put It in the Hands of Fate years ago about romantic relationships, but changed the theme to reflect the tumultuous events of the past year. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.
Sometimes we gotta find our creative. I defeated Father Time, was raised by Mother Nature. In the projects, tenement walls, sudden withdrawals. A true rebel, it's easy to spot the government flaws. Mass confusion, people in power commit collusion. Indoctrinated students, I'm the leader of the movement. Take lifetimes, trying to duck the school to prison pipeline. Disenfranchised.